Many were the strange tales they told us about the changing conditions in China, about how the old order of peace was changing, how the Russians, the men of the bear, were trying to indoctrinate the Chinese with political ideals, which to us, seemed completely wrong. It seemed to us that what the Russians were preaching was what is yours, is mine, what is mine is staying mine. The Japanese, as well, we were told, were making trouble in various parts of China. It appeared to be a question of overpopulation. Japan was producing too many children, and producing too little food, so, they were trying to invade peaceful peoples, trying to steal from them, as if only the Japanese mattered. At last we left Sikang, and crossed the border into Sichuan. A few days more, and we came to the banks of the river Yangtze. Here, at a little village, we stopped late one afternoon. We stopped, not because we had got to our destination for the night, but because there was a milling throng ahead of us, a meeting of some sort. We edged our way forward, and, all of us being rather bulky, we had no difficulty at all in pushing our way to the front of the group. A tall white man was there, standing on an ox cart, gesticulating, telling of the wonders of communism, trying to exhort the peasants to rise up and kill the landowners. He was waving about papers with pictures on, showing a sharp-featured, bearded man, calling him the savior of the world. But we were not impressed with the picture of Lenin, nor with the man's talk. We turned away in disgust, and carried on for a few miles more to the lamaserie at which we were going to stay the night. There were lamaseries in various parts of China as well as the Chinese monasteries and temples. For some people, particularly in Sikang, Sichuan, or Qinghai, prefer the form of Buddhism of Tibet, and so our lamaseries were there to teach those who were in need of our assistance. We never sought converts, we never asked people to join us, for we believed that all men were free to choose. We had no love of those missionaries who went about ranting that one had to join such and such a religion to be saved. We knew that when a person wanted to become a Lamaist they would become so without any persuading on our part. We knew how we had laughed at missionaries who came to Tibet, who came to China. It was a standing joke that people would pretend to be converted just to get the gifts and the other, so-called, advantages which the missionaries were dispensing. And another thing, Tibetans and the old order of Chinese were polite folk. They tried to cheer the missionaries, tried to make them believe that they were having some success, but never for one moment did we believe what they were telling us. We knew that they had their belief, but we preferred to keep our own. We traveled on and followed the course of the river Yangtze, the river which I was later to know so well, because this was a pleasanter path. We were fascinated in watching the vessels on the river. We had never seen boats before, although some of us had seen pictures of them, and I had once seen a steamship in a special clairvoyant session which I had had with my guide, the Lama Minya Dondup. But that is detailed later in this book. In Tibet our boatmen used coracles. These were very light frames covered with yak skin, and they would carry perhaps 4 or 5 passengers besides the boatman. Often an unpaying passenger would be the goat which was the boatman's pet, but which also did its share on land because the boatman would load his own personal belongings, his bundle or his blankets onto the goat's back while he would shoulder the coracle and climb the rocks to avoid the rapids which otherwise would wreck his boat. Sometimes a farmer who wanted to cross a river would use a goat skin or a yak skin which had legs and other openings sealed off. He would use this contraption in much the same way as Westerners use water wings. But now, we were interested to see real boats with sails, lateen sails, flapping in the wind. One day we drew to a halt near some shallows. We were intrigued. Two men were walking in the river with a long net between them. Ahead of them two more men were beating the water with sticks and yelling horribly. We thought at first that these were madmen, and the ones with the net were following them to try to take them into custody. We watched, and then, at a signal from one of the men, the clamor stopped and the two with the net walked together so that their paths crossed. Between them they drew taut the two ends of the net, and dragged it ashore. Safely up on the sandy banks they tipped the net out and pounds of shining, struggling fish dropped to the ground. It shocked us because we never killed. We believed that it was very wrong to kill any living creature. In our own rivers in Tibet, fish would come to touch a hand stretched in the water toward them. They would take food from one's hands. They had no fear whatever of man, and were often pets. But here, in China, they were just food. We wondered how these Chinese could claim to be Buddhists when they so blatantly killed for their own gain. We had dallied too long. We had sat by the side of the river for an hour, perhaps 2 hours, and we were unable to reach a lamasery that night. We shrugged our shoulders in resignation and prepared to camp by the side of the path. A little to the left, however, was a secluded grove of trees with the river running through, and we made our way there, and dismounted, tethering our horses so that they could feed on the quiet, to us, luxuriant herbage. It was a simple matter to gather sticks and to light a fire, then we boiled our tea, and ate our tsampa. For a time we sat around the fire, talking of Tibet, talking of what we had seen on our journey, and of our thoughts for the future. One by one my companions yawned, turned away and rolled themselves into the blankets and fell asleep. At last, as the glowing embers turned to blackness, I too rolled in my blanket and lay down, but not to sleep. I thought of all the hardships I had undergone. I thought of leaving my home at the age of 7, of entering a lamasery, of the hardships, the severe training. I thought of my expeditions to the highlands, and further north to the great Changtang Highlands. I thought also of the Inmost One, as we called the Dalai Lama, and then inevitably of my beloved guide, the Lama Minya Dondup. I felt sick with apprehension, heartbroken. And then it seemed as if the countryside was lit up as if by the noonday sun. I looked in amazement, and I saw my guide standing before me. "Lobsang! Lobsang!" he exclaimed, "why are you so downhearted? Have you forgotten? Iron ore may think itself senselessly tortured in the furnace, but as the tempered steel blade looks back it knows better. You have had a hard time, Lobsang, but it is all for a good purpose. This, as we have so often discussed, is merely a world of illusion, a world of dreams. You have many hardships yet to face, many hard tests, but you will triumph, you will overcome them, and in the end you will accomplish the task which you have set out to do." I rubbed my eyes, then it occurred to me, of course, the Lama Minya Dondup had come to me by astral traveling. I had often done things like that myself, but this was so unexpected. It showed me so plainly that he was thinking of me all the time, helping me with his thoughts. For some time we communed with the past, dwelling upon my weaknesses, and feeling, with a transient warm glow of happiness, the many happy moments when we had been together, like father and son. He showed me, by mental pictures, some of the hardships to be encountered and, more happily, the eventual success which would come to me in spite of all attempts to prevent it. After an indeterminate time, the golden glow faded as my guide reiterated his final words of hope and encouragement. With them as my predominant thoughts, I rolled over beneath the stars in the frozen night sky, and eventually fell asleep. The next morning we were awake early and prepared our breakfast. As was our custom, we held our morning service, which I, as the senior ecclesiastical member, conducted. And then he continued our journey along the beaten earth track by the side of the river. About midday the river bore away to the right and the path went straight ahead. We followed it. It ended at what to us appeared to be a very wide road. Actually, as I know now, it was in fact a second-class road, but we had never before seen a man-made road of this type. We rode along it, marveling at the texture of it. Marveling at the comfort of not having to look out for roots to avoid, not having to look for potholes. We jogged along thinking that in 2 or 3 more days we would be at Chongqing. Then, something about the atmosphere, something unexplained, made us glance at each other uneasily. One of us happened to look up to the far horizon. Then he stood upright in his stirrups in alarm, wide-eyed and gesticulating. "Look," he said. "A dust storm is approaching." He pointed ahead to where there was most certainly a grey-black cloud approaching at considerable speed. In Tibet there are dust clouds, clouds of grit-laden air travelling at perhaps 80 miles an hour or more, from which all people except the yak must shelter. The yak's thick wool protects it from harm, but all other creatures, particularly humans, are lacerated and made to bleed by the stinging grit which scratches the face and hands. We were certainly disconcerted because this was the first dust storm we had seen since leaving Tibet, and we looked about us to see where we could shelter. But there did not appear to be anything suitable for us. To our consternation, we became aware that the approaching cloud was accompanied by a most strange sound, a sound stranger than any of us had ever heard before, something like a temple trumpet being played by a tone-deaf learner, or, we thought miserably, like the legions of the devil marching upon us. Thrum thrum thrum, it went. Rapidly the roar increased and became stranger and stranger. There were clatters and rattles with it. We were almost too frightened to do anything, almost too frightened to think. The dust cloud sped toward us faster and faster. We were terrified and almost paralyzed with fright. We thought again of the dust clouds in Tibet, but most certainly none had ever come at us with a roar. In panic we looked again to find some place of shelter, same place where we should be protected from this terrible storm which was coming upon us. Our horses were much quicker than we at making up their minds where to go. They broke formation, they reared and they bucked. I had an impression of flying hooves, and my horse gave a most ferocious whinny, and seemed to bend in the middle. There was a strange tug, and a feeling that something had broken. "Oh, my leg is torn off," I thought. Then my horse and I parted company. I sailed through the air in an arc, and landed flat on my back at the side of the road, stunned. Rapidly the dust cloud came nearer, and I saw inside it the devil himself, a roaring black monster, shaking and shuddering. It came and it passed. Flat on my back, head up, I saw my first motor vehicle, a battered old ex-American lorry, traveling at its noisy top speed, driven by a grinning Chinese. The stench from it. Devil's breath, we called it later. A mixture of petrol, oil, and manure. The load of manure which it carried was gradually being bounced off, some of it was being jolted over the side to land with a splat beside me. With a clatter and a roar the lorry whizzed by, leaving clouds of choking dust, and a plume of black smoke from the exhaust. Soon it became a weaving dot in the distance, weaving from side to side of the road. The noise abated and there was no sound. I looked about me in the silence. There was no sign of my companions, perhaps even worse, there was no sign of the horse. I was still trying to disentangle myself because the broken part of the girth had twisted round my legs, when the others appeared, one by one, looking shamefaced and highly nervous in case any other of these roaring demons should appear. We still did not quite know what we had seen. It was all too quick and the clouds of dust had obscured so much. The others sheepishly dismounted, and helped me to brush the dust of the road off my garments. At last I was presentable again, but, where was that horse? My companions had come from all directions, yet not one of them had seen my mount. We looked about, we called, we looked in the dust for any sign of hoof marks, but we could find no trace whatever. It seemed to us that the wretched animal must have jumped into the lorry and been carried off. No, we could find no trace whatever, and we sat down by the side of the road to discuss what to do. One of my companions offered to stay at a nearby hut, so I could have his horse, and he would get back on his companion's return, when I should have been left at Chongqing. But I would have none of this. I knew as well as he did that he wanted a rest, and it did not solve the mystery of the missing horse. My companion's horses whinnied, and from a nearby Chinese peasant's hut a horse whinnied in reply. It was soon stifled, as if by a hand over the nostrils. Light dawned upon us. We looked at each other and prepared for instant action. Now, why should a horse be inside the poverty-stricken hut? That ramshackle building was not the home of a man who would own a horse. Obviously the horse was being concealed from us. We jumped to our feet and looked about us for stout clubs. Finding no suitable weapons about, we cut them from the nearby trees, and then we set off to the hut, a determined troop, suspicious of what was happening. The door was a rickety affair with thongs for hinges. Our polite knocking produced no reply. There was dead silence, not a sound. Our rude demands for entry elicited no response. Yet, previously a horse had whinnied and its whinny had been suppressed. So we made a fierce onslaught on that door. For a short time it withstood our efforts, then, as the thong hinges showed signs of parting and the door tilted and appeared to be on the point of collapse, it was hastily thrown open. Inside was a wizened Chinaman, his face contorted with terror. It was a wretched hovel, filthy, and the owner was a tattered rag bag of a man. But that was not what interested us. Inside was my horse with a bag round its muscle to keep it quiet. We were not at all pleased with the Chinese peasant and indicated our disapproval in no uncertain manner. Under the pressure of our interrogation, he admitted that he had tried to steal the horse from us. We, he said, were rich monks and could afford to lose a horse or two. He was just a poor peasant. By the look of him, he thought we were going to kill him. We must have looked fierce. We had traveled perhaps 800 miles and we were tired and rough-looking. However, we had no unpleasant designs upon him. Our combined knowledge of Chinese was entirely adequate to enable us to convey to him our opinion of his act, his probable end in this life, and his undoubted destination in the next. With that off our minds and most certainly on his, we resaddled the horse, being very careful that the girth band was secure, and again we set off for Chongqing. That night we stayed at a small lamaserie, very small. It had 6 monks in it, but we were given every hospitality. The night after was the last night of our long journey. We came to a lamaserie where, as the representatives of the inmost one, we were greeted with that courtesy which we had come to consider as our due. Again we were given food and accommodation, we took part in their temple services, and talked far into the night about events in Tibet, about our journeys to the great northern highlands and about the Dalai Lama. I was very gratified to know that even here my guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, was well known. I was interested too to meet a Japanese monk who had been to Lhasa and studied our form of Buddhism, which is so different from that of the Zen. There was much talk of impending changes in China, of revolution, of a new order, an order in which all the landowners were to be thrown out and illiterate peasants were to take their place. Russian agents were everywhere promising wonders, accomplishing nothing, nothing constructive. These Russians, to our mind, were agents of the devil, disrupting, corrupting, like plague destroying a body. The incense burned low and was replenished. It burned low again and again, and was replenished. We talked on, our talk was full of foreboding for the dire changes which were taking place. Men's values were distorted, matters of the soul were not considered to be valuable nowadays, but only transient power. The world was a very sick place. The stars rolled high in the sky. We talked on and at last one by one we lay down where we were to sleep. In the morning we knew our journey would come to an end. My journey for the time being, but my companions would return to Tibet, leaving me alone in a strange unkind world where might was right. Sleep did not come to me easily that last night. In the morning after the usual temple services and a very good meal we set out again on the road to Chongqing, our horses much refreshed. Traffic was more numerous now. Lorries and various forms of wheeled vehicles abounded. Our horses were restive, frightened. They were not accustomed to the noise of all these vehicles and the smell of burnt petrol was a constant irritant to them. It was indeed an effort to stay in our high-peaked saddles. We were interested to see people working in the fields, the terraced fields, fertilized with human excreta. The people were clad in blue, the blue of China. They all seemed to be old, and they were very tired. They moved listlessly as if life was too great a burden for them, or as if the spirit was crushed and there was nothing more worth living and striving for. Men, women and children worked together. We rode on, still following the course of the river which we had rejoined some miles back. At last we came in sight of the high cliffs on which the old city of Chongqing was built. To us this was the very first sight of any city of note outside Tibet. We stopped and gazed in fascination, but my gaze held not a little dread of the new life which lay ahead before me. In Tibet I had been a power in the land through my rank, through my accomplishments and my close association with the Dalai Lama. Now, I had come to a foreign city as a student. It reminded me all too vividly of the hardships of my early days. So it was not with happiness that I gazed at the scene ahead. This, I well knew, was but a step on the long, long track, the track which would lead me to hardships, to strange countries, stranger even than China, to the west where men worshipped only gold. Before us stretched rising ground with the terraced fields clinging precariously to the steep sides. At the top of the rise grew trees, which to us who had seen so few until recent days seemed to be a forest. Here, too, the blue-clad figures worked on in the distant fields, plodding along as their remote ancestors had plodded before them. One-wheeled carts drawn by small ponies rumbled along, laden with garden produce for the markets of Chongqing. They were queer vehicles. The wheel came up through the center of the cart, leaving space on each side for the goods. One such vehicle which we saw had an old woman balanced on one side of the wheel and two small children on the other. Chongqing. End of the journey for my companions. The start of the journey for me, the start of another life. I had no friendship for it as I looked at the steep gorges of the swirling rivers. The city was built on high cliffs quite thickly clothed with houses. From where we stood it appeared to be an island, but we knew better. We knew that it was not so, but was surrounded on three sides by the waters of the rivers Yangtze and Keeling. At the foot of the cliffs, washed by the water, was a long wide strand of sand, tapering off to a point where the rivers met. This was to be a spot well known to me in later months. Slowly we mounted our horses and moved forward. As we got nearer, we saw that steps were everywhere and we had a sharp pang of homesickness as we climbed the 780 steps of the Street of Steps. It reminded us of the Potala. And so we came to Chongqing. Chapter to Chongqing, we went along past the shops with brilliantly lighted windows, and in those windows were materials and goods of a kind which we had never seen before. Some of them we had seen pictured in magazines which had been brought to Lhasa over the Himalayas from India, and before reaching India from the USA, that fabled land. A young Chinese came hurtling towards us on the weirdest thing I had ever seen, an iron framework with two wheels, one in front, one behind. He looked at us and could not take his eyes away. Through this he lost control of the framework, the front wheel hit a stone, the thing turned sideways, and the rider went straight over the front wheel to land on his back. Some elderly Chinese lady was almost swept off her feet by him. She turned round and berated the poor fellow, who we considered had already suffered enough. He got up, looking remarkably foolish, and picked up his iron framework with the front wheel buckled. He put it across his shoulders and went on sadly down the hill, the Street of Steps. We thought we had come to a mad place, because everyone was acting most peculiarly. We went slowly along, marveling at the goods in the shops, trying to decipher what price they would be, and what they were for, because although we had seen the magazines from America none of us had understood the slightest word, but had entertained ourselves with the pictures alone. Further along we came upon the college which I was to attend. We stopped, and I went inside so that I could report my arrival. I have friends still in the hands of the communists, and I do not intend to give any information whereby they can be identified because I used to be most intimately connected with the young Tibetan resistance movement. We most actively resisted the communists in Tibet. I entered, there were three steps. I went up these and into a room. Here there was a desk at which a young Chinese was sitting on one of those peculiar little platforms of wood, supported by four poles and with two more poles and a crossbar to support the back. What a lazy way of sitting, I thought, I could never manage like that. He looked quite a pleasant young fellow. He was dressed in blue linen as most of the Chinese were. He had a badge in his lapel which indicated that he was a servant of the college. At sight of me his eyes opened quite wide, his mouth started to open as well. Then he stood up and clasped his hands together while he bowed low. I am one of the new students here, I said. I have come from Lhasa, in Tibet, with a letter from the abbot of the Potala Lama Zuri. And I proffered the long envelope which I had treasured so carefully during our journey, and which I protected from all the rigors of travel. He took it from me, and gave three bows, and then, Venerable Abbot, he said, will you sit down here until I return? Yes, I have plenty of time, I said, and I sat down in the lotus position. He looked embarrassed and fidgeted nervously with his fingers. He stepped from foot to foot and then swallowed. "Venerable Abbot," he said, with all humility, and with the deepest respect, "may I suggest that you get used to these chairs because we use them in this college?" I rose to my feet and sat down most gingerly on one of those abominable contraptions. I thought, as I still think, I will try anything once. This thing seemed to me to be an instrument of torture. The young man went away and left me sitting. I fidgeted, and fidgeted. Soon pain appeared across my back, then I got a stiff neck and I felt thoroughly out of sorts with everything. "Why," I thought, "in this unfortunate country one cannot even sit properly as we did in Tibet, but here we have to be propped up from the ground." I tried to shift sideways and the chair creaked, groaned, and swayed, and after that I dared not move again for fear that the whole thing would collapse. The young man returned, bowed to me again, and said, "The principal will see you, Venerable Abbot. Will you come this way?" He gestured with his hands and made for me to go ahead of him. "No," I said, "you lead the way. I don't know which way to go." He bowed again and took the lead. It all seemed so silly to me, some of these foreigners, they say they will show you the way and then they expect you to lead them. How can you lead when you just don't know which way to go? That was my point of view and it still is. The young man in blue led me along a corridor and then knocked at the door of a room near the end. With another bow he opened the door for me and said, "The Venerable Abbot, Lobsang Rampa." With that he shut the door behind me and I was left in the room. There was an old man standing by the window, a very pleasant old man, bald and with a short beard, a Chinaman. Strangely, he was dressed in that awful style of clothing which I had seen before, that they call the Western style. He had on a blue jacket and blue trousers and there was a thin white stripe going through. He had on a collar and a colored tie, and I thought what a sad thing that such an impressive old gentleman has to get rigged up like that. "So you are Lobsang Rampa," he said. "I have heard a lot about you and I am honored to accept you here as one of our students. I have had a letter about you in addition to the one you brought and I assure you that the previous training which you have had will stand you in very good stead. Your guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, has written to me. I knew him well some years ago in Shanghai before I went to America. My name is Li, and I am the principal here. I had to sit down and answer all sorts of questions to test my knowledge of academic subjects and my knowledge of anatomy. The things that mattered, or so it seemed to me, the scriptures, he tested not at all. I am very pleased with your standard," he said, "but you are going to have to study quite hard because here, in addition to the Chinese system, we teach according to the American method of medicine and surgery, and you will have to learn a number of subjects which were not previously in your curriculum. I am qualified in the United States of America, and I have been entrusted by the Board of Trustees with training a number of young men in the latest American methods and correlating these methods to suit conditions in China." He went on talking for quite a time, telling me of the wonders of American medicine and surgery, and of the methods used for diagnosis. He went on, "Electricity, magnetism, heat, light and sound, all these subjects you will have to master in addition to the very thorough culture which your guide has given you." I looked at him in horror. The first two, electricity and magnetism, meant nothing to me. I had not the vaguest idea what he was talking about. But heat, light and sound, well, I thought, any fool knows about those. You use heat to heat your tea, you use light with which to see, and sound when you speak. So what else is there to study about them? He added, "I am going to suggest that as you are used to hard work, you should study twice as hard as anyone else, and take two courses together, take what we term the pre-medical course at the same time as the medical training. With your years of experience in study you should be able to do this. In 2 days' time we have a new medical class starting." He turned away and rustled through his papers. Then he picked up what from pictures I recognized as a fountain pen, the very first I had ever seen. He muttered to himself, "Lobsang Rampa, special training in electricity and in magnetism. See Mr. Wu. Make a note he gets special attention." He put down his pen, carefully blotted what he had written, and stood up. I was most interested to see that he used paper for blotting. We used carefully dried sand. But he was standing up looking at me. "You are well advanced in some of your studies," he said.